Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Call's One Planet series. The Trump administration's rush to open critical areas in the United States to oil and gas drilling has put the spotlight back on the impacts of drilling on climate change, fragile ecosystems, and communities with intimate ties to those areas. One of the areas targeted is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the country's largest and wildest piece of publicly owned land. The refuge is home to over 700 animal and plant species. Polar bears, caribou, wolves, and so many other animals roam its 19.6 million acres. Golden eagles build their nests on its cliffs, and migratory birds come from all over the world. The refuge has also been home to indigenous communities for millennia. Through his photography and activism, today's guest, artist, activist, and photographer, Sabankar Banerjee, has long documented the Arctic's connections to larger global issues like resource wars, toxic migration, and human rights struggles of the northern indigenous communities. Sabankar Banerjee leads the Land Arts of the American West program at the University of New Mexico, where he also teaches art and ecology. Sabankar is the author of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Seasons of Life and Land. He's also editor of Arctic Voices, Resistance at the Tipping Point. And Sabankar Banerjee joins us from the studios of KUNM in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hi, Sabankar. Welcome back to the show. It's nice to have you back. He's there. We're just having some technical problems, I think, on our end. So today we are going to talk about this incredible ecosystem. I watched a documentary about the Arctic last night, and I mean, most of us will never go there, but it is just an incredible place, and indigenous communities have been fighting for decades to ensure that it remains untouched. If so many of these animals are affected by oil and gas drilling, indigenous communities will have a very difficult time surviving. And if you have any questions or comments about the Arctic, we'd love to hear from you. We are currently hoping to reach Sabankar Banerjee in just a couple minutes. And here's some interesting news about Sabankar Banerjee. We had him on back in 2003, when he published his first book called Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Seasons of Life and Land. And this is a beautiful book of photographs. Barbara Boxer actually used some photographs on the floor of the Senate to show people how climate change is affecting the Arctic. And at that time, the Smithsonian agreed to put the photos inside the museum, but the Bush administration pressured the Smithsonian Museum to put the photos in the basement. And that is when Sabankar Banerjee really got international attention, because media outlets around the globe were shocked that something like this would happen in the United States. And I believe that now we have Sabankar Banerjee. Hello. Hi, can you hear me?
Clearly.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. Today we are joined by Sabankar Banerjee, who heads the Land Arts of the American West program at the University of New Mexico. And Sabankar, while we were trying to get you on the line, I was talking about the book that you did back in 2003. It was a book of beautiful photos. And this is, I think, when we had you on for the very first time. Barbara Boxer was still a senator at that time, and she used your photos on the floor of the Senate to show politicians the effects of climate change. And the Smithsonian agreed to display your photos, but under the Bush administration, they ended up putting the photos in the basement. I was just telling listeners about that story.
That is now part of American history, environmental history. Yeah, it was quite a difficult time, because, you know, the Smithsonian censored the exhibit following Senator Boxer's use of the photographs of the Senate floor, which, by the way, her passionate testimony ended up in a victory for the conservationist and the indigenous Gwich'in people of Northeast Alaska and Northwest Canada. And following that, the exhibit was censored. Then there was a media outcry. There was a Senate hearing and a Senate investigation. I was even called a liar by Senator Ted Stevens on the Senate floor, following which I had feared even possible deportation. But now it's all back in history, and indeed, it's so good to be talking with you again, because we spoke about it back then.
We did, and it's amazing to think that was in 2003. Wow, here we are 15 years later, and it's so difficult to even keep up with the Trump administration's attacks on the environment. I mean, we're seeing rollbacks, just so many things. The EPA, Scott Pruitt, our guest Michael Mann said that he's basically doing exactly what the Heritage Foundation wants him to do. What are your thoughts about what we're facing right now? How much damage is this administration doing to our ability to fight climate change?
It's unprecedented, in fact. In the sense, I think you used the correct word, they're doing so much. Just to give you a couple of examples, just in 1 month, from December 6th through January 4th, because, you know, I'm mostly working on Arctic Alaska issues. So in that 1 month period, President Trump signed the GOP tax bill, which includes, tucked away in that bill is a little known provision, which Senator Murkowski got passed through a really backdoor process. That authorizes drilling, opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas development, which happens to be, as we spoke in back in 2003, a global, an ecological nursery of global significance, and a place that is sacred to the Gwich'in Nation, because they call it the sacred place where life begins. That was December 22nd, after Congress passed the tax bill. Prior to that, on December 6th, the administration held an oil lease sale in the National Petroleum Reserve, which is in the western Arctic, west of the refuge, which also is just as significant. It's 23 million acres, the size of all the state of Maine. It's massive, and it's ecologically extremely significant and culturally significant to the indigenous people. And they called it the largest ever oil lease sale inside the petroleum reserve. I mean, by the way, the name itself is wrong. It should not be called a petroleum reserve. But we can get to that a bit later. Nevertheless, there was not much interest. They offered lease sales for 900 tracts. But there was not much interest from oil industry. Only 7 leases sold that day. 7 bids were made. Following that, on January 4th, the Trump administration released the five-year 2019-2024 offshore oil and gas lease sale, the largest offshore lease sale in the U.S. history, both in terms of the number of leases offered, which is 47. There are 19 leases in Alaska, 12 in the Gulf of Mexico, 9 in the Atlantic along the Atlantic coast, all the way from Florida to Maine, and 7 along the coast of California, Oregon, Washington. Total 47 lease sales, largest ever, and more than 1 billion acres of actual amount of water that is being leased, which is also the largest ever. So if you put all this together, and this has all happened within 1 month period,
wow.
On top of that, they have basically weakened and trying to get rid of the offshore drilling safety equipment regulations as well as oversight. So what they're doing is truly, I would call it unprecedented. In a way, the Reagan administration also, we have a similar situation with President Reagan being the president back in 1981, and his EPA and the Secretary of Interior. We are in a very similar situation now with Ryan Zinke, really a kind of a front person for the extractive industry, is running the Department of Interior, and Scott Pruitt at EPA. It's unprecedented attack, so that's why what we need is coming together of different elements of the conservation and the human rights movement to really come together to fight this. And it is happening, and that is happening.
Right. You have been to the Arctic many times. You have met with indigenous tribes who are fighting this. Can you tell us about the some of the people that you have met who have been fighting and to protect their land?
So I spent back in 2001, 2002, 14 months in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, both in the land as well as in the Guichin community of Arctic Village, which is on the south side of the Brooks Range, just on the southern border of the Arctic Refuge, and on the north side, the Inupiat community of Kaktovik, the coastal people. And since then, I have been, I mean, the Arctic, the work we did back then really changed my life in every sense of the term, forever. And so I have ever since been deeply involved with Arctic campaign. So I work very closely with the Guichin communities and the Inupiat communities. On the Guichin side, there are 15 villages in Northeast Alaska, Northwest Canada, and I have been to about six of those at various different times. And for them, it's a human rights issue, opening up the Arctic Refuge coastal plain to oil drilling, because that is where the Porcupine River caribou herd gives birth. And for the Guichin people, they have always called themselves the caribou people. We are the caribou people. That's how they say it, because they depend on the porcupine caribou herd for nutritional, cultural, and spiritual sustenance for many millennia. So for them, it's a human rights issue, and they have been fighting this. Actually, what the public knows, since 1988, when the Guichin Steering Committee was founded during the Reagan administration to fight this issue as a unified voice of all of the Guichin people across Alaska and Canada. So it's a unified voice. But some of my recent work, I was in Alaska again last October and met with Guichin leaders, many Guichin leaders, including Sarah James, who won the Goldman Prize, among other many international awards. And she told me, you know, the Guichin people have been trying to protect the caribou since going back all the way to the 1960s. So it's been a very long battle for them. So now that the Trump administration has authorized drilling, the Guichin people are fighting back in a big way, working with the conservation community. The Guichin Steering Committee executive director is Bernadette Demientiev, with whom I work very closely. So there are many things that will happen. So just because the Trump administration has authorized this does not mean much, because the way the conservationists and the Guichin people are saying that the fight is only beginning, meaning it's entering a new chapter. So they have now authorized it. And that means there'll be fight through legal challenges. There'll be actual lawsuits filed. All the details are being worked out now, as well as legislative, because there are just an incredibly large number of lawmakers, both on the House and the Senate side, who support conservation of the Arctic Refuge and have done so for decades, and they're not going to back down. And the grassroots campaign, the public, American public, more than two-thirds actually support protection of the refuge. So there are multi-front initiatives that are happening right now with regard to that. And in fact, I'm actually hosting a symposium at my home institution, University of New Mexico, next month, February 21 through 23rd, called The Last Oil, where we are actually bringing in all elements, the Arctic Refuge, the Arctic Ocean, and the Western Reserve, and people who know about these, indigenous people, conservationists, policy people, artists, activists, they're all coming.
Talk about how climate change is affecting indigenous peoples in the Arctic. Climate change, according to a number of reports, is heating up the Arctic far faster than anywhere else in the world. The ice covering the Arctic Ocean has shrunk rapidly. 50% of the summer ice extent disappeared in just the last 50 years. So how is climate change affecting indigenous communities?
So this is probably the most important point, and I'll mention several things with regard to that. So at the turn of the century, 2002, there was a workshop called Sea Change Workshop that happened in Finland, where they passed a resolution which essentially said that the Arctic indigenous people are already being severely impacted by climate change, but the rest of the world's citizens have not yet seen the impacts of climate change, so no action is being taken. So this assessment was made going all the way back to 17, 18 years ago. That said, with regard to climate change, some of the most foundational work has been done in the Arctic. There was a Barrow Consortium that happened also around that time. Then there was a report published called Impacts of a Warming Arctic. That report was published in 2004, which was about, let's say, a quarter inch thick or a little more than that. 3 years later, in 2007, Impacts of a Warming Arctic was published, and this report was nearly 3 inches thick by University of Cambridge Press. And that report is the one that was the most significant component of what went into the IPCC report, the UN International Panel on Climate Change. So the Arctic, as you correctly noted, is warming much faster than the rest of the globe, actually more than twice. And Arctic Alaska in particular is warming at an extreme rate. Last month in December, in Barrow, which is the northernmost Arctic community in the U.S., which sits at the confluence of the two great seas, the Beaufort and the Chukchi Seas, the Arctic Seas, which also the Trump administration is opening up to oil and gas. In Barrow, and this is December Barrow, where the temperature should be minus 40, minus 50 degrees, in Barrow, the temperature was so warm that the computers of the National Oceanic and Administrative Administration, NOAA, thought this is an error. So they put Barrow out of their temperature map, which made actually national headlines. And so the Arctic is warming at an unprecedented rate. And what that does is the climate change in the Arctic is having severe impact on the indigenous communities. For a variety of reasons, part of it, as you correctly noted, is the extreme melting of the sea ice, which is creating unprecedented coastal erosion, which is because of receding sea ice, much larger open water, as well as warmer water and warmer temperature giving rise to much more intense storms, which is also happening elsewhere, as well as sea level rise. So the combination of the three things, receding sea ice, intense storms, and sea level rise, all of those impacts of climate change are affecting coastal communities in Arctic Alaska. Then you are adding, and it's actually impacting infrastructure. So multiple communities will have to relocate, literally like now. Mm. So which is a very huge thing for them, that you have lived in some place for 1,000 years and now you have to relocate. So that's taking place, and there is absolutely no federal agency that can actually deal with relocation, which is most American public don't even know that. There is no such agency that exists to help them with relocation. And the other thing is melting of the permafrost, which is having a very serious impact with regard to infrastructure as well as homes, because permafrost is melting. But the melting permafrost is another bigger issue, because it also releases methane, which is technically on a 20-year timeline is nearly 100 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So all of those combinations are having impact on the Arctic animals as well as the indigenous communities. But one thing to note is those impacts don't just stay in the Arctic. They impact the rest of the planet, all over the planet, because Arctic is technically the integrator of our planet's climate systems. Both our oceanic and atmospheric processes are actually controlled by the Arctic. Very interestingly, not Antarctic, but the Arctic.
Mm.
And because of that, whatever happens in the Arctic affects the whole Earth. So last year, as you may remember, three Category 4, Category 5 hurricanes hit the Gulf of Mexico and the eastern seaboard, Harvey, Irma, Maria, in a succession, which is unprecedented in a single season, which, as we all know, had enormous impact, devastating impacts on coastal communities. And several places like Bermuda has been basically devastated, kind of off the map. And Puerto Rico, as we have seen, has suffered severe devastation. And then in California in particular is suffering because in California we had the fire in December, out of season extreme fire, devastating fire. Then in California, just earlier this month, we had the mudslide, which has also been linked to climate change, which also killed people and destroyed property. So impacts of climate change, going back to that 2002 resolution in Finland, is now everywhere and has intensified. And because of all this, our British journalist George Monbiot is calling that we should not be using the term climate change. We should use the word climate breakdown. Mm. And in all of that, Arctic is the driver. So further destroying the Arctic with oil and gas is a crime that the Trump administration is advancing. But we are fighting it.
It is amazing to think, Sabankar, and this fact got a lot of attention last year, that the Arctic will be free of ice sometime around the 2040s. I mean, this is shocking to think of. We're talking 22 years. This is just 22 years away.
It's probably far before that, because the person who has studied Arctic sea ice continuously for 45, more than 45 years now, is Professor Peter Wadhams, who just retired from the University of Cambridge in 2016. And Peter and I know each other extremely well. I was at Cambridge in 2016, and his book came out last fall by Penguin, as well as the University of Oxford Press, called Farewell to Ice. And what Peter has shown, which is much more advanced numbers than what the IPCC has done, he claims that within just a handful of years, not 22 years,
wow,
within two or three years, the Arctic summer sea ice will be completely gone. And he's really the most kind of scientist who has continuously done research on Arctic sea ice for more than 45 years. So it's very disturbing what is happening. But the other thing that has not gotten attention in the U.S. media, national media, much at all, is because of that melting sea ice and the combination of warmer water, because the water is also warming as the sea ice is melting, the subsea permafrost is melting, which is releasing methane from the subsurface of the sea, which is a much, much bigger issue than anything else. And so Peter and his colleagues had done studied, and several Russian scientists, that shows that the subsea methane release from the Arctic could cause such devastating impacts that the world has not seen. And it's not getting much attention right now, but that's what we are dealing with.
Today we're joined by environmental activist Sabankar Banerjee. He heads the Land Arts of the American West program at the University of New Mexico. He's the author of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Seasons of Life and Land. This is Your Calls One Planet series. Today we are talking about the Arctic, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Rewire's editor-in-chief Jody Jacobson will join us in studio to talk about the ongoing attacks on reproductive rights, women's health, transgender rights, access to health care. Rewire is an incredible website that extensively documents latest developments about reproductive justice. And then on Wednesday, we are going to talk about immigration and all of the deportations that we've been seeing. Families are just being torn apart. People who've been here for decades are being deported. We'll also try to get an update on the Chronicle's report about an ICE crackdown here in the Bay Area. And then later in the week, investigative journalist David K. Johnston will be in studio to talk about his new book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Today, we are speaking with environmental activist Sabankar Banerjee. He's joining us on our One Planet show focused on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Sabankar heads the Land Arts of the American West program at the University of New Mexico. He is editor of Arctic Voices, Resistance at the Tipping Point, and you can find out more about his work and see his incredible photos at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today to talk about the Arctic, as Sabankar said, this really affects the entire planet. In fact, Michael Mann last Monday was on the show and talking about the connections between extreme weather and what we are seeing in the Arctic. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And let's hear from Ben, who is with Defenders of Wildlife, calling from the South Bay. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yes, I'm calling from the southeast here in North Carolina.
Oh, southeast. Hi, thank you.
Yes, yeah, glad to join you all. Just wanted to weigh in because I think it has been pointed out by your guest today, this certainly is an issue that affects us not just in the Arctic, but across the continent and across the globe, in fact. And here in the southeast, we're particularly concerned about the reckless and irresponsible offshore drilling proposal that we're dealing with at this time.
So, Ben, what can you talk about, for example, how Defenders of Wildlife and other organizations are fighting this? What's most effective at this point?
Well, I think at this point what we're really doing is trying to engage and mobilize as many citizens as we can to weigh in. There, of course, is a required public process that we're going through, and you know, there is certainly some arguments about whether or not this process is unfolding fairly, but we have to show up. We have to be there. So right now we are collaborating with a number of organizations all across the country to make sure that when they do have these public meetings that we are showing up in force to make sure the administration and the officials that are responsible for making this decision hear our voices loud and clear. And that is not just from everyday citizens, it's also from our elected officials and leaders, you know, taking into account the fact that over 142 municipalities on the East Coast, including over 1,200 local, state, and federal elected officials, have all come out in staunch opposition to this proposal.
And Ben, we'd love to do a show about wildlife on another One Planet Monday. I just went to your website, and in very bold letters it says, "Stop Donald Trump's assault on wildlife." Can you tell, I mean, this is a big question, but what concerns you the most about what wildlife are facing under this administration?
Well, it's coming in a number of forms. From where we sit, obviously, one of the things we're most concerned about is the Trump administration's efforts to undermine the very laws that our wildlife and our country depends on to secure wildlife, including the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, all of these, you know, bedrock environmental laws that have allowed us to make progress in conservation and environmental stewardship for many, many decades are now becoming undermined and reversed and redacted. So we're having to face that onslaught on Capitol Hill. And then you have really egregious proposals like this, completely unprecedented moves to expose coastal communities and wildlife offshore to the disaster that could be another BP oil spill, any location.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for calling in, and thank you for your work. We'd love to have you on a future show.
Of course. Glad to be on. Thank you.
Thank you. That is Ben calling in from North Carolina. He's with Defenders of Wildlife. Sabankar, there is so much wildlife in the Arctic. I mean, all you have to do is a quick search online, and it's just, it's incredible. How is climate change currently affecting wildlife in the Arctic?
Well, let me just elaborate on some of the points that Ben just mentioned. So thank you, Ben, for calling. So I am working with Ben's colleague here in New Mexico, Michael Dax, who is the local representative of Defenders of Wildlife, who is working very closely with me on the Last Oil Symposium that will take place at UNM next month. You can check it out, thelastoil.unm.edu. Back to the Arctic. So the Arctic seas that the Trump administration is trying to open up, the three seas combination, Bering, and then Chukchi, and then Beaufort. Those seas are considered the least understood and among the ecologically most complex seas on Earth. Their biological diversity is astounding and very complex. So late last fall, Audubon Alaska published an enormous volume of studies, actually supported by one of the foundations in California. It's called the Ecological Atlas of Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas. And it's available online, this incredible, amazing document. And the Director of Conservation of Science, Melanie Smith, is also coming to Albuquerque to speak. So So those seas are incredibly rich ecologically. So I wrote a piece a few years ago called Walking the Waters, in which I describe a scene off of a California coast. I think it was off of somewhere around Monterey Bay, where the tourists were seeing blue whales. I mean, large number of blue whales, which is an incredible once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So what I connected is that those whales that you are seeing in California coast are actually going up to those Arctic seas that the Trump wants to open up to oil and gas, because that's where they feed. So some of the most significant feeding grounds for 8 different species of whales, as well as for some of them calving, is and migration route is up on those seas. So even people in California are in a way directly connected to those Arctic seas, because the whales that are going up all the way from Mexico to the Arctic are passing through California. The Arctic refuge, which is, as I mentioned, the coastal plain that the Trump administration and Alaska delegation has approved opening up to oil and gas drilling, the longest continuously running environmental campaign in the history of the Earth, not just North America, going on for 7 decades now, is a biological nursery of global significance. It is called the America Serengeti, because the caribou that gives birth in the coastal plain, the Porcupine River herd, is now numbering around 200,000. It's actually a little over 200,000, 218,000 now. Their migration is the longest land migration of any mammal on Earth. So they connect all these indigenous communities across Alaska and Canada through their migration. And I talked about the human rights issue a little bit earlier. And that coastal plain is also has millions of birds, 200 species, that are coming from all over the world, including my childhood home, India, yellow wagtail. And there are birds that are coming all up and down from California coast and interior California, going up to the Arctic refuge to nest. So these places that they're trying to open up, again, I keep using the word global biological nurseries, is a crime. At a time when the planet is going through the 6th mass extinction. So the work that Defenders of Wildlife is doing, as Ben mentioned, and his colleague Michael Dax in New Mexico, and the work like Alaska Wilderness League, Wilderness Society, Audubon, NRDC, and the Human Rights Organization, I work with 2 very closely up in Alaska, actually several. One is Gwich'in Steering Committee. The other is Red Oil, Resistance to Destruction of Indigenous Land, Native Movement, they're in Fairbanks. They're all now working together to fight Trump's... this is a crime. This is outright a crime that they're doing, both against wildlife, against all these non-human animals that we share this planet with at a time of the mass extinction and die-off, as well as climate change and the egregious violation of indigenous human rights.
Well, and then there's this headline from National Geographic, animals are shrinking and freezing to death in a changing Arctic. And I'll just read part of it. Muskoxen, the plant-chomping, long-haired mammals that huddle on the Arctic tundra are being born smaller in parts of the far north as pregnant mothers struggle to find food. One reason, according to new research published in Scientific Reports, muskoxen eat most of the year by pawing through snow with their hooves, but rising temperatures mean precipitation increasingly falls as rain, only to then freeze on the surface, encasing plant life in inaccessible ice. I mean, it's amazing to see this happening in
Actually,
our lifetime, Sabankar.
Rose, I'm glad you mentioned this. This is what I wrote about in my first book that you mentioned, 2003. If you go back, I wrote about this very specific thing going back 15 years ago. And we had witnessed this going way back, and back then no one was reporting on it, except a handful of scientists who was observing this thing, is in the winter in the Arctic, the temperature is becoming so warm that when it should be minus 40 degrees, it's raining. So then you have a rain comes and followed by cold temperature, so it's creating ice. So then the tundra is becoming covered with thin sheet of ice that these animals like caribou and muskoxen cannot break through with their hooves. They're not used to. Their hooves are designed for digging through snow to find food, but when it's ice, they can't break that ice. So there is a huge issue going on with Arctic animals, land animals, with regard to starvation and die-off, which is part of the larger mass die-off that I'm speaking of. And it's all over the place. And in the Arctic, it's also quite intense.
Sabankar Banerjee is an environmental activist, photographer. He also heads the Land Arts of the American West program at the University of New Mexico. He's the author of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Seasons of Life and Land. He's also editor of Arctic Voices, Resistance at the Tipping Point. Today, it is our One Planet series. Every Monday, we talk about the environment, our planet, climate change. And today, we are talking about the Arctic and how indigenous communities and of a wide array of groups are fighting the Trump administration's plan to open the Arctic to oil and gas drilling. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go next to Richard calling from the Ocean Foundation in Bodega Bay. Hi, Richard. Welcome
to
the show.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for exposing what snuck into the tax bill in terms of opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This was really an environmental crime in terms of the U.S. Congress. And I'd like to thank the individual from Defenders in the Southeast for broadening the conversation to include offshore drilling, because a lot of people are just finding out that the entire California coast, up to 3 miles from shore, excepting only our National Marine Sanctuaries, is going to be open for offshore drilling right here. I mean, this is being decided now, and that includes Oregon and Washington. And you asked what people can do, and there's actually a public, it's called a listening session, but it's like a hearing held by the Interior Department right in Sacramento on Thursday, February 8th, from 3 to 7 p.m., and that's at the Sacopolis Library Galleria at 828 I Street in Sacramento. That's a listening session that's the only hearing in the entire state of California on February 8th in Sacramento. So I encourage people to actually go to that, because there is something you can do, and if you can't get to that, you can submit written comments at a new website called savethecoast.org, savethecoast.org, and those comments are due on March 9th. So really the fate of the entire U.S. Outer Continental Shelf, all of our coastal waters, is being decided by the Trump administration right now.
Thank you, Richard, for bringing that up. Let me elaborate that a little bit right now. So the Trump administration, not only, as we discussed earlier, is opening up more than 1 billion acres of coastal water all over the country, but they're also undermining the public input process. And what Richard just mentioned is, and I'll elaborate, is they are allowing this kind of public, what they call listening session. This is really not a public testimony or a public hearing that used to happen in the past. But nevertheless, it's happening only in 23 states and only in the state capital. So imagine a state like California or Alaska, massive state, so only one place they're doing this hearing. How would people who live like 500 miles or 1,000 miles away would come to this? So there has been a repeated request from environmental organizations, the public, as well as lawmakers, to do two things to the interior. One is to increase the number of these locations where hearing could take place, particularly local people who would be impacted by this. All of our coastal communities across the country who would be impacted. So they should be hosting hearings in 100 times more than that number, 23. Second thing is that to request an extension, 60-day extension beyond that March 9th date that Richard mentioned. Neither of those two, Secretary Zinke has yet responded. So they're not only opening these things up, they're not only trying to weaken and get rid of regulations, safety regulations and oversight, but they're also undermining the public process. Like, nothing like this has ever happened before, and they're pushing it through in an incredibly fast-track manner. That said, more than 150 members of the House and nearly 40 senators have also bipartisan opposition to the drilling, and they have sent letters to Secretary Zinke, Department of Interior, So it's happening at all levels. There is opposition at the congressional level. There are coastal governors across the state, except two, that have also voiced opposition. And there are these requests coming from the environmental and the human rights organization and coastal communities to both increase the number of locations as well as the deadline. But the Department of Interior is moving forward as if none of that matters.
Mm. Well, Richard, thank you for calling in and thank you for that information. Again, the website, if you'd like to write a comment, is savethecoast.org. You have to do that by March 9th. And then if you are in the Sacramento area, there is what the Interior Department is calling a listening session. It's the only one in the entire state on offshore drilling. Thursday, February 8th, at the Sacapulas Library, 828 I Street in Sacramento. 828 I Street in Sacramento. And it starts at 3 o'clock, 3 to 7 p.m. And we'll put information on our website. So thank you for that crucial information. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. I just have to laugh at the idea that coastal drilling will happen. You know, to me, it's just a ploy for Trump to have allowed Rick Scott in Florida to say no to offshore drilling and up his chances of being a senator. What do you get? He would never drill off coast, and the lawsuits would come hard and fast. What would you guys say?
What do you think, Sabankar?
Oh, so the thing is that, thank you for your call. So even the Florida, there was a little bit of a flurry of national news about Rick Scott asking the Department of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, and the two together made a press conference. But even that, the Secretary of Interior has not made a commitment. So Florida is definitely not off the table either. Because if Florida is taken off the table, then there are all these other Republican governors who are also shouting. So it's all right now fairly confusing to understand, but nevertheless, the Department of Interior is very serious about opening up all of these areas to oil and gas. And I will just mention a little bit of the California history, because you are out there, and California was the first state in this nation, at least, that really suffered the horrendous impact of an offshore spill, which happened in 1969 off of the Santa Barbara coast, the famous spill. That actually, many people may or may not know, led to the first organizing of the Earth Day in 1970. That led to the passage of the National Environmental Policy Act. That led to the founding of the Environmental Protection Agency. All of that was inspired by what happened off of the coast of Santa Barbara. 22 years later, it was actually a Republican president, George H.W. Bush, used the 1953 OCSLA, Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, to set aside the Monterey Bay Marine National Wildlife Refuge, National Marine Wildlife Refuge, or National Marine Sanctuary. That happened in the 1990s by George H.W. Bush by using the 1953 law. The same law President Obama used at the end of his term after having supported offshore drilling for nearly 8 years. But nevertheless, at the end of his term, he used the 1953 Oaks law to set aside basically all of the Arctic seas. President Trump is trying to undo that. And that's what he's doing, not trying. He is undoing that. That has never happened in the history of this country, that one president comes in and does the undoing of another president's either Antiquities Act or the Oaks Law invocation. So that also is quite unprecedented. So, but it will be fought very hard in court. So I didn't mention that earlier, the whole unraveling of the Oaks Law designation that Trump is trying to do will be fought in court. So there are multiple fronts this fight will take place, both for the Arctic Refuge and the Arctic Seas and other seas like Richard's Atlantic Coast and the Pacific Coast, is going to be fought both legally, legislatively, and on the ground by grassroots activism.
Well, thank you for the call. We have an email from Charles. He writes, I spent two field seasons in Alaska, just outside of the Arctic Refuge. People who haven't been there may not realize how narrow the wildlife-rich Arctic plain is through the refuge. This is the area where most of the bird and animal life concentrate during the summer. Noise from drilling rigs and aircraft can be heard for many miles, and the noise alone from oil activities would change the wilderness character of Anwar. Can you tell us more about this, Savankar? And what do you, what kind of reaction do you expect from oil companies? I mean, how many oil companies are actively there right now?
This is a very important point. So let me mention that narrowness that the person who emailed, it's one of the most significant thing, because the coastal plain in the Arctic Refuge is indeed very narrow compared to what's going on where oil development has been going on is Prudhoe Bay, where the coastal plain is very wide, meaning the animals that are giving birth inside the coastal plain have nowhere to go. So if they are disturbed, they are basically disturbed and they have to abandon their birthing, nesting, calving grounds. So that comment was a very significant comment the person who emailed pointed out. And because of that narrowness of the coastal plain, bunch of different ecological things happen, including the highest concentration of polar bear dens on the entire Arctic coast of Alaska or in the United States. That all takes place inside the refuge because of the narrow coastal plain. So all that said, indeed, if development does happen there or even seismic exploration, it will have very severe impact on the animals on the coastal plain as compared to in Prudhoe Bay. And science has already shown all of that. And then your second question you men asked, if there are oil companies. So right now, of course, no oil company has been there. The only thing that was allowed by Reagan administration was some seismic testing in 84-85, and there was one oil drilled, one well was drilled in 1986, that's it, and then nothing has happened since then. And we don't even know whether oil companies will be really that much interested, mainly because to do drilling in the Arctic is, first of all, is extremely harsh environment, and it's extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. So while the oil prices stay below $80 a barrel, it's unlikely that very many oil companies will show interest, which is exactly what happened with regard to the Western Arctic that I was talking about. While Trump administration offered lease sale on 900 tracts, only seven bids were made. That said, plus there are these legal challenges, so oil companies are more nervous about that. And on the offshore side, this is why Shell pulled out, combination of harsh weather, potential legal challenges, and other issues. Shell did pull out. So we don't know whether even the oil companies would be interested. So yes, the Trump administration is pushing for it, Alaska delegation is pushing for it, but if the public get engaged, we can derail this really suicidal trajectory for the planet, for the animals with which we inhabit this earth, and for our indigenous brothers and sisters.
And the most effective way to do that, we talked about getting involved in terms of drilling off the California coast, but what about the Arctic?
Arctic Refuge is right now, absolutely, write to your members of Congress, call your members of Congress, because that fight is still very relevant on the legislative side. So there is a wilderness bill very much active in Congress, and we are increasingly getting more and more co-signers for that. So please keep working with your House and Senate, members of the House and the Senate. There is the legal side, which will, of course, be taken up by legal organization and grassroots organizing, because the way we are looking at, you know, whether it's Time's Up movement, whether it's what's happening with immigration reform, whether we are talking about Black Lives Matter, people got engaged, there is awareness, and we will see what happens with regard to proper legislation. In the Arctic and all of these environmental attacks that's taking place, unprecedented, we need grassroots organizing. So the way public can help is call your members of Congress, write letters, and another key thing is write letter to the editors. That's very, very important. Write letter to the editors, write to your members of Congress, and get engaged with environmental organizations and human rights organizations who are fighting this fight. We need this right now.
Sabankar Banerjee is an environmental activist and photographer. He's the author of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Seasons of Land, Life and Land, and is editor of Arctic Voices, Resistance at the Tipping Point. Sabankar also heads the Land Arts of the American West program at the University of New Mexico. Sabankar, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back soon.
Thank you so much, Rose, for giving voice to the Arctic and the people and the animals. Thank you. And to all your listeners and those who called in.
Thank you so much. And coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Rewire's editor-in-chief Jody Jacobson. We'll talk about how journalists should hold politicians accountable for their attacks on women's health. Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you'd like to sign up for our podcast, or if you missed any of last week's shows, we spoke with climatologist Michael Mann, who says this administration is the most anti-science and anti-environmental administration in history. We also talked about attacks on abortion 45 years after Roe. We spoke with women who remember what life was like when abortion was illegal. You can podcast the show, yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihei Razazan for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.